Hello, my name is Marie Fisher, and I'd like to welcome you to the Women on Wednesday series, Still Fighting for Our Rights 30 Years Later. A few housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off all cell phones and pagers, and please stay in your seats until 12:50. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, as we do use this for future programming. In the United States today, millions of adolescents and young adults are struggling with eating disorders, and many do not have adequate health insurance to cover this illness. This presentation will address the historical, sociocultural influences, as well as the signs, such as media and societal messages that contribute to the development of eating disorders, as well as the signs and symptoms of anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. Further, this session will define normal, healthy eating behavior and offer support to someone who may be suffering from an eating disorder or disordered eating. Join us in opposing the dangerous practice of glorifying thinness and resolve to take care of your body. Sharon Johnson is a registered dietitian with a Bachelor of Science in Nutrition from the University of Minnesota. Her work history includes securing national grants, developing curriculum and educational materials, and teaching nutrition courses in Minnesota public schools. Johnson has developed and presented various seminars on health, wellness, and food safety to adults in both public and private settings, and was a fitness instructor for over 18 years. Her professional interests include nutritional needs specific to sports and athletics, health and wellness, children, and those with eating disorders. Johnson currently facilitates binge eating disorder groups and conducts initial assessments at Park Nicolet Eating Disorders Institute at Methodist Hospital. We are very grateful to have her here today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Sharon Johnson.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me. We have a lot of material to cover in a little time, and I tend to talk really fast, so can you listen fast? It'll work best if we can work in sync with that. I'm kind of going to do things in a little reverse order than the intro. We're going to first talk about what is normal eating so that you get a basic understanding of what normal is, because I think a lot of times we get away from that. We don't even know what that is anymore. Then we're going to talk about what are eating disorders and get into those a little specifically. And the last chunk of this, we'll be talking about the origins and the socioeconomic influences that are causing and exacerbating eating disorders. So first of all, what is normal eating? It's basically following four tenets. You eat when you're hungry. Eat foods that you like to eat. Eat with enjoyment, or what we call mindfulness. And stopping when you're no longer hungry. Sounds really simple in principle, but when you practice these and break it down, if you had to write a page right now on what it feels like when you are hungry, could you really do that? Do you know physically what your hunger feels like? What are the little cues that it's time to eat? Do you know what foods you like, and do you allow yourself to eat them? Or are those the forbidden foods, or reward foods, or treat foods? Or are they just normal foods that you have once in a while? When you're eating, are you focused on eating, or are you talking, are you texting, are you doing homework, are you doing other things, watching TV, being otherwise mindlessly engaged in the eating? And stopping when you're no longer hungry. That's another one. I don't know if everyone is aware of that. We can usually identify when we're over full. It's that after Thanksgiving, stuff's so bad, my belly hurts, gotta lay down, open my pants, lay on the couch, don't touch me, don't even come near me feeling. But how about when you're just satisfied, when you're no longer hungry? When you're done eating, you should have enough energy to get up and go clean up the dishes or do some laundry, do something. You should not feel like you have to go lay down because you're too tired, because you're just too full. That means too much energy is going into your intestinal tract to digest that food. There's too much in there at one time. So thinking about those things, they sound really simplistic, but how many of us really eat that way every time? Do you start by asking yourself, am I hungry? Most of us don't do that. We're on a schedule, aren't we? We're thinking it's time to eat. Any of you have any experience babysitting or have little brothers or sisters or nieces, nephews? What do they do when they're hungry?
They cry.
They cry, right? Now if you're holding little Johnny here and where you're not going to eat until 12:30 and you're holding him and he's crying and you say, oh, Johnny's only 5 after 12. We have to wait until 12:30. Does Johnny just shut up and wait till 12:30? Not a chance, right? Johnny's going to keep screaming and screaming until he gets some food because he knows he's hungry. So you're feeding him and you come to the, must be cream spinach, I'm thinking. And he likes that, so he's eating it. Then you switch over to the liver, the ground liver, and Johnny doesn't like that. What does he do? Spits it out, right? Doesn't like that food. He's only going to eat the likes and enjoys eating. Then when he's done, when he's no longer hungry, what does he do? Spits it out again, right? Or they bat your hand away, they twist their head, they clamp their little gums shut. You can't get a spoon in there to save your soul. They're done. That intuitive sense, am I not coming through?
Is that better? Oh my gosh, I'm loud. Now I have to talk quietly. Hold my enthusiasm down. Is that okay? Move it down. Put it down there. That's a little better, because it's hard for me not to talk loud. Especially I'm so excited about him getting his cream spinach here. So babies, infants are born with that intuitive sense to know when they're hungry, they know what they like, and they know when they've had enough. But we lose that. We lose that over time. Now, all of us, probably most of us here, were born human babies, so we all had that inside of us. You've still got it inside of you. That intuitive sense is still in there, but what happens is we tune it out. We learn to go by external cues instead of internal cues. And one of the biggest ways our society does this is with daycare or preschool. When they sit you all down, some of you probably went to a preschool or a daycare, kindergarten maybe, where they sat you down at 10:30 and you had your graham crackers and your warm apple juice. Did you always want the graham crackers and the warm apple juice? I know I didn't. Sometimes you want something else. Sometimes you're not even hungry. But the provider is giving you that food, and this unconscious message starts to be created that someone else knows what I want and how much. So we start trusting external cues. And as you go through the school system, all of a sudden now you have a lunch hour or a lunch 20 minutes. And then it's time to eat. You might not be hungry. You might not want what's on the menu. But it's time, and so you have to eat then because it's in your schedule. So all these things, then you get up, grow up, and you get a job, hopefully, in your field making lots of money. And you have a lunch break, and you have to take your coffee break when it's scheduled, then your lunch break when it's scheduled. And then you get married and have kids, and you're taking them to hockey and violin lessons and all this stuff, and you're eating in between the activities, because that's when you have time to eat. So all those external things kind of come at us, and we stop tuning in to the inside, the internal cues. What's so great about normal eating, about getting back to that? There's this incredible balance that happens when you leave your body alone and just let it lead you. You're sitting in here now. How many of you are consciously controlling your blood pressure right now? How about pulse rate? Body temperature? Seems ludicrous, right? Your body knows how to do that. Well, your body knows how to eat, too. It knows how to fuel itself. But we stop listening to it. So it's got this great automatic system that will balance things out between all the nutrients it needs. It protects your metabolism. If you're eating on a regular basis, your metabolism stays nice and high. That means everything's running at top speed and top form. One of the ironic things about people who go on diets is they're trying to lose weight and their metabolism does what? Slows down, so it's defeating the purpose. One of the reasons diets will never work. So you get this optimum mental and physical performance when you let your body go and let it lead you to its natural, healthiest spot and let it tell you what it wants, how much it wants. So that's kind of normal eating in the middle of a continuum. It's body-led, it's internally regulated, it's flexible. You notice there isn't a dot here on the line. It's a range. Some days you're going to eat more, some days you're going to eat less. That's normal. Some days you do it because you have no time, or it's a holiday and Aunt Martha brought her famous homemade Mounds bars and you just love those cookies. Different reasons, but it's a flexible thing. Where we get in trouble and where we get into the eating disorders are at either end of it. The one end of the continuum is very restrictive eating, a lot of rules, a lot of rigidity. And the other end is almost the opposite, binge eating, huge, thousands of calories at one time, out of control eating. So the ends of the continuum, signal eating disorders. The middle part is normal eating or healthy eating. So let's look a little bit at the eating disorder categories individually. You've probably heard of the first one, anorexia nervosa. I like to call it the diva of the eating disorders. Most of the attention goes to the anorexia disease. Most of the funding for research and treatment goes to anorexia because, in part, it was the first diagnosed eating disorder, and also because out of all the mental health diagnoses, all of them, not just eating disorders, all mental health diagnoses, anorexia has the highest mortality rate. Let that sink in a minute. So if you had any other mental disorder, you stand a better chance of staying alive than you do if you have anorexia. Bulimia nervosa, binging and purging. Eating disorder not otherwise specified is a category that is dumped out there when someone doesn't neatly fit into one of these other boxes, we call it not otherwise specified, can be anything from people who are on chronic diets, people who only eat after 5 and before 6 p.m., people who only eat things that are yellow. I don't, any rule you can make up, any kind of disordered eating kind of falls in this catch-all category. And binge eating disorder is now becoming its own category. We have found that these people with this disorder need separate treatment and have different things going on medically than the ones who are purging with it. So these would be people who binge thousands of calories, 2 pizzas, a quart of ice cream at one time, and they don't do anything to get rid of it. Have you guys heard of the DSM-4? Anyone with a psych or medical background? Okay, it's a diagnostic and statistical manual. It's basically a big book that lists all the mental disorders that are categorized, and they're given a number, and then for insurance purposes, when you're diagnosed, they take that number and they can kind of say, oh, you're a 124.62. So it's just a big book that sort of categorizes and numbers all the disorders, psychological disorders. So anorexia in there, these are the classic requirements, if you will, to be diagnosed with anorexia. These people tend to, just in a general way, they're very restrictive, tend to be perfectionistic. They are straight A-plus students, usually doing a multitude of volunteer things while they're in school, typically involved in music and sports and other things, just going all the time. Characteristics of these people, these are the stereotypical ones that you will be able to pick out in the street. Very thin, usually. And I just want to make a point that you don't have to look emaciated to have anorexia, nor do you have to have anorexia if you look like this. This is just stereotypically how we see these people who have been living with the disease for a while, tend to be very underweight. You know, we all probably know about the osteoporosis thing and how they're losing their bone density. A couple things that you might not know or might not think about is when the body starts to lose mass, okay, it's all geared to survive. We're all geared to survive. So anything extra that it doesn't need goes. Okay, sexual reproduction goes. Testosterone levels plummet. Menses stops. Hair growth. You don't need this to live. Out goes your hair. You lose clumps of hair. Okay, anything that's extraneous, your fingernails, that's extra. You don't need that to live. Out it goes. When it uses up most of the fat in your body that it can for energy to stay alive, it goes to muscle. So it starts to break down your muscle. What's your heart made of? Muscle. It will take heart tissue as well. We see a lot of cardiac problems with people with anorexia because they're literally losing their heart muscle because it's using that as that tissue, breaking it down for energy to live. So typically they are in the worst health state of any of the eating disorders. And typically they're very easy to pick out. These people are interesting when they come in because they are constantly trying to burn calories. They will stand rather than sit. They will pull a chair up and they will hover above it like this the whole hour you're working with them, hovering an inch or two above the chair, because this takes a lot more calories than actually sitting in the chair. They will move their legs, drum their fingers. I had a patient once who bought a stick shift car because that used a little more energy than an automatic. Any little thing that they can do to burn one more calorie, they will do. It becomes an obsession. Their whole day is about burning the calories. And their twin cousin, the bulimia nervosa. These are the diagnostic criteria for bulimia. But basically, in a nutshell, these people eat large amounts of food and then get rid of it. They can use laxatives, diuretics, throwing up, over-exercising. I have one patient right now who exercises 7 hours a day. You go, well, how can she live? She doesn't have a job. She lost her job because she couldn't do her job because she couldn't balance that with 7 hours at the gym. 7 hours a day of constant motion, trying to burn up the calories. I had another client who came in once and talking about the throwing up. Usually, by the way, they use their fingers to throw up. Some will use toothbrushes. That's really popular, too. But usually your fingers are pretty much always with you wherever you go, so you don't have to forget to pack them. You're not in trouble. So that's a common thing, and we usually see a lot of knuckle bruising and tissue scraped and raw from the acids. So anyway, this client came in, and she said, you know, I'm to the point now where I don't have to make myself throw up. I just go in the bathroom and I lean over the toilet and I throw up. Just the motion of leaning over caused her to throw up. And she looked at me dead faced and said, what should I do? What's the answer? Don't bend over, right? Obvious answer. She was so far, she couldn't get there. She didn't know what to do. How do I stop throwing up? Don't bend over. So you know, these symptoms can just get so severe and the people so lost in the disease that a common sense thing like that just blows right by them. Bulimia nervosa, can you pick out a bulimic? You can pretty much tell an anorexic. Bulimic's harder. There's no typical body type because it depends how much they're eating in their binge, how long until they throw up because some of those calories will be absorbed. Are they using laxatives and diuretics rather than throwing up? Because that means the food is getting into the intestinal tract where it's going to be absorbed at least partially. So there's all these different factors. Are they exercising? And then there's muscle mass versus fat mass and all these things. So you can't really pick out a stereotypical bulimic other than the ones who are purging a lot tend to have really thick necks. Now think about this. If you've ever had the flu, when you throw up, you get that hydrochloric acid from your stomach goes up in your mouth, right? Tastes awful. It's not supposed to be up there. The only place in your body that has cells that can handle hydrochloric acid is in your stomach. So when it gets up through your throat, your esophagus, into your mouth, it burns. Well, your body's response to that is to make more saliva to help wash that acid out so it saves your tissues in your mouth and your throat. Now imagine if you're throwing up 7-8 times a day. You're going to need a lot more saliva produced, right, to clear that acid out? So your salivary glands, you have a pair under here and a pair behind your throat, and they have to hypertrophy. They have to grow really big and strong to produce all that saliva. So sometimes we'll see chronic bulimics, or people who are throwing up chronically, and they'll come in and they'll have almost like a goiter. They have really very thick necks because you can just see the salivary glands sitting out there. A lot of dental discoloration too with these patients, depending on how long they've been doing it. You know, cancers of the gums, the mouth, dental caries, all those things because of that acid that's not supposed to be up in their mouth. And this was the not otherwise specified. When you don't fit neatly into one of the other two boxes, they kind of put you in this category. And again, you can't really tell these people because they're going back and forth. So it's not like you can see someone and say, "Ha, oh, you have EDNOS." Binge eating disorder. The big difference is the no purging. They are totally devastated emotionally when they have these big binges, but they don't do anything to compensate for that to get rid of it. Thankfully, because they would be medically more compromised if they were purging. And again, you can't pick these people out. Although typically we see an older population with this. Stereotypically, women in their 40s to 60s, overweight by 15 to 100 pounds is kind of the generalization that we're seeing in this category right now. Some statistics. We talked about anorexia having the highest premature mortality rate. And look at these last four. 80% of American women are dissatisfied with their body. There's now a new term out there called normative discontent. And you might start hearing this more often. It's getting a little more common. And it means that so many of us are so used to being discontent with our bodies that now is where we've placed the bar and said this is normal. There's normative discontent. And you might think worse of yourself based on that or better, but that's kind of now ground zero. Isn't that kind of a scary thought? Ground zero should just be, hey, we're all okay. But now normative discontent is where we've placed ground zero. 42% of first through third grade girls, these are 7, 8, 9-year-old girls, discontent, want to be thinner. 81% of 10-year-olds are afraid of being fat. This is girls and boys. I have a good friend whose son is 10 years old and he's being treated for anorexia. He thinks that he'll be faster at running the skinnier he is. So we've got those messages are still out there. 25% of American men, 45% of American women are on a diet on any given day. It's rampant in this society. We are diet freaks in this country. So let's talk about the origins of some of these. How do people get these eating disorders? We kind of looked at normal eating, what's abnormal or eating disorders. What happens? How do we get there? Well, there definitely is a personality predisposition or association. Not necessarily the causation, but we do see a lot of the obsessive compulsive perfectionistic types, particularly with the anorexia disease. Substance abuse seems to be coexisting in a lot of bulimics more than the others, but certainly can be across all eating disorders. Home environment, parental influence, a lot of physical sexual abuse. Where do people go? They go inside their body. They either want to gain a lot of weight so they are unattractive, or conversely, they want to lose a lot of weight because they don't want to exist. They just want to blend in. Nobody look at me. I want to be so small. Nobody sees me. Nobody touches me. Excuse me. This is a big one, lack of self-awareness and self-confidence. Starts very young. That's where those elementary kids, we can catch them if we can get them at that early age. and get them off of the thinking I'm, you know, body shape, size should not be an issue in second grade. Participation in certain sports. I had hoped that this had changed over the last 20 years, but it really has not. Wrestling, dancing, gymnastics, ice skating, any sport where there's an emphasis on thinness and the look of that athlete, or where it is an advantage to be small, tends to spawn eating disorders. And dieting to achieve the ideal body. So these are some of the ways people fall into eating disorders. So I'm going to pull you back for a little bit. Now let's look at beauty as a function of culture and time. So this whole thing in our culture about thinness, it isn't worldwide. It isn't in every culture. And it wasn't even in our culture forever. Sometimes we lose sight of this and we think, well, the whole world and for eternity, thin is better. It's not. This is a superficial thing. So try to pull back as if you're coming here as an alien from another planet and looking at this, okay? We're going to take a look at some cultures. In India, 1,000-year-old sculptures show very voluptuous women, full breasts, full bellies, full hips. They did not love the stick figure. China, remember reading about bound feet or seeing pictures of this? That was their cultural idea of beauty. We wouldn't think of doing that in this culture. We've never done that. 19th century Hawaii. This was a powerful woman, a woman to be looked up to be revered. So what's our ideal body in America? Back at the turn of the century, the late 1800s into early 19, Lillian Russell was the ideal. She was 5'3", 180 pounds. Voluptuous, curvaceous, 5'3", 180. Do you know that now she'd be considered obese by our standards? Back then, that was health, that was beauty. The corset came in the 20s and created this hourglass figure, small waist, more curves. Have you ever heard of fainting couches? Back in those old, they'd, and they'd faint. Most of that was real. They did faint because their ribs were so squished. They could only wear these corsets for so long because it squished their lungs. It was hard to breathe with these things on. I recently saw on, what are those shows where they, the person who does the most jumping jacks, Guinness Book of World Records. You ever seen these Guinness Book shows? There's just a woman on there who has the smallest waist of any living female. Do you know how big her waist was? 15 inches. 15-inch waist. Most people's thighs are bigger than that. And she wears a corset 22 of 24 hours a day and has for over two decades to push her waist in that small. So it's still a bizarre kind of thing for some people, apparently. That corset thing spawned the Gibson girl. And there were a lot of cartoons. There's a lot of memorabilia with the Gibson girl figure. Again, very curvaceous, very tiny waist. Then we shifted in the 20s. The flapper was a big deal. And this was kind of a boyish look. The short hair, very straight, shoulders to waist to hips, very straight, thin, straight legs, no curves. It's like the anti-Gibson. Fast forward to the 50s, Marilyn Monroe, who also would be considered overweight, borderline. She would be a size 14 now. Okay, she'd definitely be in the big girl section. But she was the sex goddess in the 50s. Then the 60s, everybody knows Twiggy, right? 5'8", 97 pounds. And she was quite young when those pictures, most of them, were taken. She happened to be one of the less than 5% of our population who naturally has that thin, tall, straight look. So more than 95% of us don't look like that, but yet that's what we represent as our cultural ideal. So now think about this. If a woman born at the turn of the century lived, you know, say more than 90 years, what would she have had to do to keep up with all this? Okay, she would have had to be very voluptuous, very, you know, Lillian Russell. Then she would have had to slam on a corset, squish her waist, stop breathing for a while, get small enough to be a Gibson girl. Oh, then the 20s, better pull that waist out, flatten the breasts, make her boyish, lose any extra curves she had. Oh, then back to Marilyn Monroe, got to get the curves back again. And now Twiggy, oh, now stick, no curves, no nothing. So if you look at this from far away and watch this transition of what is ideal, you get a feeling how superficial it is, right? It's very subjective, and it's just time-oriented. Who says that 5'11", 117, which is our current model's average stats, Who says that in another 5 years that's going to be the ideal? Or 10 years or 20 years? Maybe 5 foot two, 175 pounds is going to be the new big thing. Who knows? So why try to strive for something that isn't you naturally when it doesn't matter? It's all superficial. Somebody made this stuff up. There is no real right perfect shape to be. Does that kind of make sense? When you pull back and look at it from far away? Somebody just is making this stuff up. It's not real. Today's ideal? Average model weighs 23% less than the average woman. Slight height and weight difference there. I love this next slide because look at this. When I first saw this ad, I thought this was a doll. Doesn't this look like a doll? Like a plastic? This is a woman. This is a living human being. I was absolutely stunned. This is a model. As we grow, the tendency to want to look like the models, to put ourselves down for not looking like the models, grows. Unless we can have a change in our thinking. Part of the reason is because you're swamped with images more and more, thousands and thousands every year. And so every year you live longer, you've had that much more in your memory bank of what is ideal. So how can we restore normal eating, get out of all this eating disorder stuff, and get back to just being normal and focus on other things? By the way, did you know there's $50 billion spent annually in this country on diet aids? $50 billion with a B? Just on diet aids. Not nearly that much spent on eating disorder treatment. So what can you do? The best thing you can do, and probably the easiest thing that you can do, is to practice those four tenets of normal eating. Ask yourself, am I hungry? If not, do something else. If yes, what do I want? Get what you want, enjoy it. Am I no longer hungry? If you are no longer hungry, stop, go do something else. If you're still hungry, go have a little more. Ask yourself again, loop back. This is like a computer flow chart thing. Okay? Practice that. Model healthy eating and exercise behaviors. You know, you're a role model everywhere you go. Right now, everyone sitting in this room is a role model because someone else is in this room. The only time you're not a role model is when you're alone. And then you're still a role model to yourself. So I hate to put the pressure on you, but every one of you affects everyone else who looks at you, talks to you, comes in contact with you. So every time you say something derogatory about yourself or someone else in terms of their weight, their looks, their body shape or size, that's a message that somebody else is picking up out there. And start listening to the ones you're picking up, too, from other people. It's interesting. Now that you're aware of it, how those things are going to kind of pop out at you. Just say no to dieting. The more you diet, the more you need to diet because your metabolism slows down and it sets up this untenable situation where you just can't win because you have to restrict more and more and more. Oh, and speaking of restricting, we have time today. Let's do a little fun thing here. I'm going to time you guys for 30 seconds. And I just want you to sit there, relax, and think about anything you want to think. You can go on spring break in your head, whatever. But for 30 seconds, I don't want you to think one time about bananas. Okay, anything else? Okay, close enough. Who went the whole time without thinking of or picturing anything to do with bananas? How many of you, immediately when I said, except bananas, went right to the bananas? Isn't that incredible? That's how our minds work. That's how we're rigged. That's what happens. So when you go on a diet, you're going to want the thing you're not allowed. If I say to you in here, you can't have desserts the rest of this diet, is going to be 45 days, no desserts. What's the one thing you're going to want for 45 days? Desserts. That's how we're wired. So diets can't work just by that reason alone. That's in a nutshell why you can't stay on a diet forever. They are time dependent. And you get off of it and you go get the thing you've been restricting. Because think about it. A diet restricts something, whether it's the type of food you can have, the time you can eat, a category of food, the number of calories, number of fat grams, something is missing that you can't have, and so you're going to be focused on that thing. So between that inability to stay away from it and the metabolism slowing down, diet's really not a good idea. Don't work. Espouse body acceptance. I really challenge you all to work on this. We need a paradigm shift in this country so bad, so bad, so bad. Sit in a mall, sit in a restaurant sometime and just listen to what's going on around you. Listen to the conversations. If you have a job, sit there at work and listen. What are people talking about? Overwhelmingly, it's about weight, shape, body, image, dieting, food. It's incredible how much energy we spend as a country focused on this. So I would really like if you'd all go out and just change the world, and I wouldn't have to do these talks anymore. Just sit at home, be in my jammies. Don't discount your influence. You are out there. You are affecting everyone you interact with. I love this picture because I hope that, first of all, I love the way this little girl is looking up at these. There's a whole story here, you know. You just look at her being happy and looking at these great role models. These women are out there in swimsuits, and they're clearly senior citizens, and they're out there having fun. I know so many people in their 20s who will not put on swimsuits because they're embarrassed of how they look, or they're afraid they look fat, or they don't look good enough. You know, if we could just have this kind of normalization and get these people into ads. Now, speaking of ads, there are a couple inroads being made in that. I'll just mention this, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. Dove, the people with the shampoos and soaps, not the candy people, have a great website, dove.com, and you can go there and see things that they're doing to promote positive feelings and positive awareness. They've got great little video clips on there that you can see. One of them that they had was a model who comes into the ad agency, and she's no makeup or anything, just ready to get going. And they do a time lapse where it goes really fast. And they show her makeup getting put on and her hair being done and all this stuff. And they go to take her picture, and it's dramatically different from when she walked in there, right? Okay, well, that's bad enough. But then they take the picture, and they show you how they computer enhance it. They lengthen her neck. They change her hair color. All these things that go on. And so then they show you the billboard. And so you see from this woman to the billboard, and it looks nothing like her. If you were in a crowd of one, you couldn't pick her out, that this was a person on the billboard. It's dramatically different. Then the other clip they have, which is really good, they show a little elementary girl. She's got long, kind of frizzy, reddish hair and freckles. She's with her friends, and they're just laughing, having a good time, and you seem like this normal, happy, healthy girl. And they show, kind of going through her day, all the images that impact her and come at her. And I think it's even called impact or something. And they're fast, too. And so they're coming at you with billboard shots and ads on TV and magazine covers and magazine pictures and all this stuff just really fast about, you know, lose weight, change your hair, change your nose, change your teeth, change your height, you know, all this stuff. And then at the end, this girl is just standing there kind of walking across the street, and she's just like, just stunned. I mean, it's just taken everything out of her. And you just really get the sense of what we're doing to younger kids. This is the first image-based generation coming up. You guys are the start of it. I was print-based. We got our information through printed materials. You guys learn through images. That's where you're getting your stories, your messages from. And it's changed the whole ballgame of how we produce those things. Also, another little thing about marketing. You know the before and after pictures? They're really after and befores. Did you know that? It's cheaper and better, and they know the end result if manufacturers and marketing people go and look for what they want the after to look like, take those pictures and then pay that person to not put on makeup, gain some weight, slack off at the gym, and make that the before picture. Because think about it, if they went and got someone like me and put me on a program, I might not end up looking the way they want to, and so they wasted all their time and money. So often they're switched, before is after, after is before. Lots of stuff on marketing, we could talk for hours, but I want to get time for Q&A. So kind of talked about normal eating, eating disorders, and kind of what they are, how we got there from here. Questions about any of that or anything else? Bree? Oh, body dysmorphia. Very common disorder. In fact, I think it's probably going to end up being like normative discontent where it's just assumed everyone has it. But severe body dysmorphia is when someone cannot relate to what their body actually looks like. When we have people come into the Eating Disorder Institute, we often one of the things we do are we show them a chart of body shapes drawn out, and we have them circle the shape that looks like them now and put an X by the shape they want to be. And it's very telling because body dysmorphia just shows up right away on this. People who are anorexic and want to be as thin as possible tend to see themselves as very overweight and want to be in their mind, what is really skinny and often is, they often look smaller than what they pick their goal is already. So not only do they think they're big, but what they want to get down to, they've already passed that on the spectrum. And then we have some of the opposite with the binge eaters. They tend to see themselves as small, and they don't realize that they've gained all this weight. And so they have this dysmorphia thinking they're smaller than they are because they used to be thin, and they can't deal with the fact that they're not right now. They have trouble with that.
Mike? How prevalent is anorexia?
You know, the male thing often comes up, and I thank you for bringing that up. We tend to see, in the Institute, we see probably about, I would say, one male for every four or five females across disorders. Now, that isn't to say that men don't, there isn't an equal split. That's just in the statistics from people seeking treatment. There may still be a kind of a stigma attached for men to seek treatment, particularly the older men who are taught, you know, to stuff that feelings and body isn't important and it's good if you have a big belly and, you know, those kind of things. So not really sure what's going on there in terms of the population who actually has it, but in terms of treatment, we're still seeing less. But here's one thing to think about, too. What we did to our girls, you know, we've done a lot to try to bring girls girl power, girls in sports, healthy things for girls, camps that are specifically designed to empower girls, and we're trying to get the women on board with being strong and healthy. But the same thing we did to them that got them in trouble in the first place, we're now doing to the boys. We're now showing the, you know, the V shape, a lot more naked shots from the waist up. There, Abercrombie or somebody does those ads, you know, with the guys with all the muscle bound. So we're turning around and doing, we didn't learn a lesson with the girls. And now we're doing it to the boys and saying, this is the one ideal you better look like or there's something wrong with you. And so I suspect that, particularly in our younger population, the males, we're just going to continue to see more and more of them coming in for treatment. So it's really kind of sad we didn't learn our lesson. Oh, eating disorders are expensive. Don't kid yourself. Binge eating disorders. People have gotten into a lot of trouble with that. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of time. And think of time out of work because you're sick from being from the disorder or you can't focus and you've been asked to leave your job and those type of things. But yes, the not only cosmetic surgery, which has dramatically increased in the last 10 years, and speaking of which, the number one gift for high school graduation is becoming breast implants. High school, you're not done growing it. How do you know what size they're going to be? Anyway, but the other surgery that's getting really popular is the gastric bypass surgeries. We've seen that zoom up lately. And that's a whole bizarre thing because people often have an eating disorder and it's not addressed. They just focus on the weight. If I lose the weight, then everything will be rosy. So they go get this surgery and then 2 years, 3 years later, they're coming to us with this huge problem because now they're binging and purging because of the structure, the anatomical changes. They're having all kinds of trouble. Well, the eating disorder was never addressed. They never fixed the problem. So now they've not only still got the eating disorder, but now they've got these incredible physical challenges and limitations for the rest of their lives. So that's growing too, that population. Yes, it is most statistically white, Caucasian women, statistically in their teens to mid-30s, are the bulk of what we see coming in for treatment for anorexia and bulimia. Statistically, the other ethnic groups are catching up, however, and other cultures are catching up. And I talked a little bit with Mike about this. Because of our globalization and everybody moving everywhere and, you know, nobody has a single ethnic background anymore. We're so mixed. And because of all that global movement, we're carrying these disorders and this dysmorphia into other countries now. And kids with these international schools, even elementary age kids, are going to school in different countries. And so it's sort of spreading out from our insanity. That would probably fall under the eating disorder not otherwise specified, probably that area of treatment. One of the things we try to do when we treat these people, too, we're trying to always get more refined in our diagnosis. for instance, binge eating disorder used to just be with the bulimics. Well, then we realized that these people really have special needs and special skills that they need to be taught. So now we have a special segment for binge eating disorder. We have eating disorder, people with diabetes, dual diagnosis things. So we're trying to refine. We have adolescent eating disorder. That's a different population. So trying to refine this and get as many different population breakdowns as we can so we can get very specific with the treatment for these, hoping that the more specific we get, the more we refine this, the quicker we'll have success in getting people over this. I don't know if that answered your question. I kind of went over here somewhere with it. But, okay.
How long do you think it'll be before the ideal body shape or image
will? You know, that's, I thought about that a lot because of the Twiggy thing. It's from the 60s. That has really been tenacious. That's been here the longest of any. So I think that's up to your generation to get out there and get that changed. I don't know. It's an anomaly because the others have not lasted this long. Mike?
You talk about a paradigm shift. I guess, how do we have a paradigm shift if the corporations and these companies or these marketers continually market this sort of ideal for us to sort of believe in? I mean, where do you take the chance of, you know, stepping away from that? And how do we decide for ourselves instead of let them decide for us?
Well, and it is an individual thing, and you do need to decide and speak up with your cash, number one, because that's what they're after. And let's face it, they don't care what the ideal is. It's like people say, McDonald's is trying to make this country fat. No, they're not. They're trying to make a buck. They don't care if you get fat or not. They're after our money. So, number one, spend your money wisely. Number two, there are some, if you want to get a little more involved, there are some websites. There's one called aboutface.org that is very involved with marketing ad campaigns that are counter to healthy messages. You can get as involved as you want with writing those people, calling those people, spending, you know, it depends how forthright you are and how much guts you have. I have a good friend who goes into the stores, the teenage stores, where they've got the pants, you know, openness and the shirts, and she dresses the mannequins. She pulls them up and zips them and she tidies them all up and then she goes on to the next store. You know, I'm sure they, after she leaves, they're like, oh, there went Shannon again, we'll go open the... But it's her little way of making a statement that this is wrong and I'm not personally standing for this. So some of those things. You know, when you talk to your friends, when you hear this kind of conversation, how much empowerment do you have to say, you guys, you know, that's really out of line. This is crazy talk. And again, being that role model, that's a real grassroots thing we can all be. Feeling comfortable in our own skin, taking good care of ourselves to be healthy. That's really the goal, because don't we all want to live as long as we can? From other marketers, I can believe that. Everything I've heard from people, everyone seems to be very on board with it and very supportive of it. But I can imagine they're ruffling a few feathers. Levi's, too, by the way, is starting to, I'm seeing ads with older women with gray hair, shock, and women that are short and different size, shape women. So Dockers, particularly the ads of Levi's that I've noticed that coming out in. So I think there's always going to be a resistance from the status quo trying for some reason, even subvertly, to try to get them out of there because they're fighting for the same dollars. But I've only heard positive from the general public. To be sure. And Dove, and make no mistake, Dove is still after your money. But I do give them credit for at least trying to, in their quest to make money, they're at least trying to shift, trying to shift some of the opinions. And that's the piece I want to grab onto. And again, yeah, don't be naive about this. Anybody who's selling a product wants your money and they'll twist it any way they can. But let's try to support the ones, maybe, that are doing the things that we believe in. We in the back? Anorexia, still number one among college. And it's hard because, like the normative discontent, we're almost now where we kind of accept that and we think, yeah, well, they're college. They're going through their anorexic phase. You know, it's almost becoming a norm. You see these skinny girls and parents will come in and say, oh, I think she looks just fine. You know, it's someone who's 100 pounds and she's 5'8". Oh, she looks just fine to me. Okay, in what universe do you live? And was your eating disorder ever treated, Mom? I mean, you look at a lot of family things going on then, too. But, we don't accept that. That's not right. It's not normal, and it's not a normal course of progression to go through that. I'll get you in just a minute. I have a good friend whose daughter is a junior in high school, and she is one of these incredible, she's like 5'8", I don't know what she weighs, but she's a stick. And she just isn't, you look at her family history, and they're all very tall, very narrow boned, and she doesn't have curves, she's very straight. That is her genetic potential. She is clearly living up to that. But she gets approached in like a health club setting, tactfully by people that work there, because now there's this whole thing about liability. And if we let someone who's clearly got an eating disorder work out on our machines and they have a heart attack, are we liable? So she does get comments from time to time, and it is kind of hard for her because she's not, and she doesn't, she's the farthest thing from an unhealthy eater. She's just kind of genetically in that position. But when you think about the 5% too, and her age, when she's in her 20s, she's not going to look like that anymore either. Once she has children, she's not going to look like that. So the 5% is really less than 5% when you consider that's probably 16 to 20 years old when they look like that. So it can't, there's the occasional backfire, if you will, from that assumption. But again, like the Dove thing, I'd rather be safe than sorry. And she would too, rather someone approach her in those settings, public settings, and make sure rather than just assume and let it go or be afraid to approach her. Did you have a question?
Well, I had first heard the term a couple years ago, the freshman 15. Yeah.
When you're eating.
And also, I don't see a lot of that at the top of that after freshman year. I don't think people are talking about it, but it was the first time I heard the term, and I was just wondering, is that something that everybody accepts, or is it something that literally happens because you've changed your schedule?
Well, I think stereotypes kind of evolve for a reason. I mean, there has to be enough data there to start that kind of cliche. But I have heard it expressed as the consequence of being in a different food environment where food is available when they want it. Now, instead of being in the family where it's at certain times or where their schedule is sort of externally dictated, now they're more in charge of their life and they have more choices. And for those people who have been sort of ruled by other people, this is kind of a freeing thing for them, and they tend to eat more and experiment with different foods and fast foods and things that they might not have gotten at home. So I've heard that kind of connection to that freshman 15. And I don't think that should be as acceptable as eating disorders either. I think they're both, disordered eating. They're not norm. But I could see the freshman challenge of trying to come to grips, swinging the pendulum to try some of those things, figure out what works, and then probably the next year coming back to settle in more what their normal pattern would be. And that's probably why it goes away in the sophomore, junior, and senior years. In the green top? The best way we found is to be objective and use I statements. Mary, I've noticed that when we go out to eat, you never have dessert with us, or you never eat with us. Mary, I've noticed you don't have anything in your dorm room to eat. Do you ever get hungry, or how do you feed yourself? I've noticed, and specific things, the more specific you can get, and that might open the door to conversation. If Mary, and I'm just, pardon me for using you and making your name Mary, if Mary is closed up about it and, is not willing to go there, you'll know immediately. And then you might want to talk to someone in the industry or a professional to see how to approach that. But usually, if you stay on the side of, I've noticed, I'm concerned because I've seen this, they might be like, oh, relieved that somebody, there's an in there. And then refer them, of course, to a professional, whether you have someone here on staff at school or their family members, if you know their parents and you have a good rapport with them. Kind of depends where you go from there based on the individual thing. But usually an objective, factual approach from your feeling standpoint works best. Otherwise, there can be that defensive. No, I'm not.
What are some signs of children that they have a disorder? Are they the same as adults?
Yes, although children are usually more blatant about it. Like this little boy, the friend of mine who's the anorexic, was very blatant about, I'm not eating because I want to be skinny to be faster. They haven't gotten the coyness yet and the manipulation, so they tend to be more open about it. But the same type of things, not wanting to eat, refusing to eat, saying they're not hungry, or restricting certain foods, you know, like I'm not eating desserts. Oh, this is a good one. I had a 4-year-old girl who could tell me fat contents of different foods at 4. We ended up finding out it was her grandmother who was caretaking for her, who had an eating disorder and was sort of breeding that in the girl. But so they, depending on their level of sophistication, they may know which foods they're avoiding, but they're usually pretty open about why. Thank you so much. Don't diet.